DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I am delighted to be joined by John West, who is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, co-editor of the award-winning C.S. Lewis Reader's Encyclopedia, and author of Darwin Day in America. With John West, we go inside the pages of The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society, published by the Discovery Institute. John, thank you so much for joining me.
Chris, it's great to be here.
C.S. Lewis and the area of science. Unless you've read his science fiction books, you probably wouldn't put the two together.
No, that's true. He's known for the Chronicles of Narnia and books like Mere Christianity. But, you know, he had a fascination with science throughout much of his life, and he had a few dozen science books in his personal library, and he marked them up with both annotations and underlining. And so it was a topic that actually runs through his science fiction trilogy, but also books like The Abolition of Man. Even, really, one of his Chronicles of Narnia called The Magician's Nephew has a sub-theme, really, about modern science.
You are someone who knows C.S. Lewis very well. Your C.S. Lewis's Reader's Encyclopedia, it was award-winning. And I'm just curious, what drew you initially to the works of C.S. Lewis?
Well, I have to thank my sister Joanne, who, when I was in a child, she gave me a set of the Chronicles of Narnia. And so I was just enthralled and then started to devour everything else he wrote. And, you know, the more I've learned about Lewis, Lewis is one of those, I think, timeless figures. And it's not only that he was intellectually astute, but he was winsome, he was funny. You know, he was really mentored by the other people that he read, people like the great J.K. Chesterton, for example, who was a real influence on Lewis. And so, and his personal story is just really interesting, because he went from an atheist agnostic to a theist to then a Christian. And so that story is important. And, of course, some people know about his later marriage to Joy Gresham, and you know, that was big Hollywood film, and so people know about that. But just also the things that he faced as, you know, before that. Because of his outspoken Christianity, he was really voted down by his peers for professorships at Oxford University. And it was only much later in life that he became a full professor, and it was through Cambridge University, not Oxford. And it was through the private efforts of his close friend who helped lead him to Christ, J.R.R. Tolkien.
Mm-hmm. His skepticism, can we say that, of science and or the way science thought of itself, maybe, is what really kind of drove him in this area.
I'd say his skepticism of what might be called scientism, really the abuse of science outside its proper field. Lewis appreciated the findings of modern science, just like I do, and so he was very clear that he wasn't anti-science, but the effort to use the scientific method and claim that that is the only way we can know anything true, whether about faith, about society, about ethics, and then to apply, you know, scientific claims outside their proper sphere, he thought was an abuse of science. And so he did think that that was dangerous. And actually, you know, we have to understand the context in which he wrote. You know, this is the era when in Nazi Germany, they were using eugenics and really efforts to breed a master human race. There were Marxist biologists like J.B.S. Haldane in his own country who were making similar arguments in England. And so Lewis could see this use, especially in the era of eugenics, of Darwin's theory of evolution to try to apply this to human breed and how dangerous this could be.
Talk to us about Lewis and how he, throughout his life, really attacked what he called evolutionism.
Yeah, and this is a fascinating story because the story starts before Lewis was a Christian, before he even believed in God. When he, as some people may know, he was not just an ivory tower academic, but during World War I, he was actually on the front lines, and he was wounded. And while he was recovering from his wounds, still an atheist, he read a book by a French Nobel laureate, Henri Bergson, called Creative Evolution, which did embrace a type of evolution, but was very skeptical that to the reasons as why Darwin's theory of unguided evolution, of natural selection acting on these random variations, why that wasn't a good candidate for producing a lot of things. And Lewis was largely persuaded by that argument. And this was before he even believed in God. And Lewis thought that, you know, he didn't have an objection as a Christian to claims that we may have come from a common ancestor, although he ended up being skeptical of that later in life. But for him, the thing that really made no sense was the claim that it could have been a blind and impersonal process. And he basically went back to his training as a medieval and Renaissance scholar with the thinker Boethius and others, who made the point that you basically can't get something from nothing. And you can't, so if you're trying to explain something, an effect cannot be greater than the initial cause. And so when you look at things like human reason or morality, and you look at the Darwinian explanation for reason, well, it's part of an impersonal, blind, non-rational process, so supposedly led to the development of reason. Well, Lewis thought that made no sense. You're basically saying that something greater came out of a much lesser cause. And with his training in medieval philosophy, that doesn't make sense. And, you know, he'd just point out things in nature. You find rocks, but they don't magically self-assemble into houses. And so Lewis was very skeptical of the claims that an unguided, impersonal process could bring about the sorts of things we see in nature and in human beings particularly, especially the development of reason and morality.
Now, John, explain to us why this is more than just a heady coffee clutch type of intellectual discussion. There is a slippery slope that we all can slide down if we don't grasp the nuances of this discussion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the best ways to see it is through the eugenics movement and sort of the revival of that, you know, efforts for decades in America, although the Catholic Church was very strong in challenging it. The scientific community at Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Columbia thought that we could breed a master race and thought that this was good science and thought that anyone who opposed it was anti-science. Today, the number of claims made in the name of science, whether science really shows it or not, are just phenomenal. And so this isn't, you're right, just not an ivory tower discussion. From issues like climate change, which I don't have clear views on, but some people in the name of climate change actually argue, there's one scientist that we cite in our books, argues that, well, maybe we should suspend democracy. Well, okay. Mm. Lewis pointed out that these claims made in the name of science, or actually close to home, the debates over whether the government should force faith-based institutions to prescribe contraceptives or even abortion drugs, how is that claim being made? Well, actually, our Secretary of Health and Human Services in one of the early press conferences said, well, we need to do this because what? Well, because the science says so.
Mm.
Well, as Lewis would point out, no, that even if the science did say so, which I think is arguable, the Lewis's point is that's not the end of the conversation. Yes, we want people with scientific training to give their advice about things in the world and public policy, but that doesn't end the discussion. There are other values and other things important. You know, what things are worth having at what price? What things are worth giving up? Our personal freedoms, our religious liberty. Why does someone with scientific training immediately trump that? And that's raging scientism, or as Lewis, in the ending years of his life, worried about scientocracy, this claim that, well, people, just because of their training in science, now have the right to rule. And Lewis really objected to that. And we could see this here in sex education efforts and all sorts of issues where people cite and sometimes misuse the science to say, well, the science says this, whether it really does or not, therefore you have to do this. And Lewis thought that was very concerning.
It's important for us to really grasp the fact that this is just, as you said, an ivory tower, not an ivory tower discussion or one that is inclusive just in the areas of science, because it does affect society. And society is that interaction of human beings, and it involves us. So in the decisions that are made, and that's why this is so relevant.
Yes, and again, I think increasingly science, so-called, is being, and again, I'm not anti-science, neither was Lewis, but is being abused as this trump card that, especially for people of faith, whether if you believe in a more traditional view of the human family or whatever the issue is, someone will say, well, the science says otherwise, even if it doesn't, and then says, therefore, you know, you're just outdated beliefs, you can just be swept aside. And so this mode of argument is one that Lewis predicted and warned about, and that's where we're living today. And so Lewis really provides a very practical way of getting a handle on these claims and how to push back on these claims in a winsome way, but to point out that, you know, there is more to good public policy than just having a few people make claims in the name of science.
We're talking with John West, who is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, about the book that had just come out. It's called The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. And in this particular book, you have so many different essays covering a broad range of topics. Tell us about some of the standouts.
Sure. Well, for those who are really concerned about where things are today, I think in the last section of the book, we actually have people apply it. You know, what's happening to society now? And one thing is this big movement led by scholars at Oxford and elsewhere called transhumanism. It's sort of a modern eugenics program where they think that we need to use modern genetics to breed, evolve a better human race, and if we don't, we're going to die out. And these people are kind of really scary, and you'd like to think they were just fringe figures, but they're the nation's leading and the world's leading academic institutions. And so this is really something Lewis warned about in his little book, The Abolition of Man, where he talks about the dangers of this sort of re-engineering the human race. And so that's one thing. There are some essays about our educational systems and how we're training students really to disbelieve that morality is something real because it's just a blind and purposeless, a product of, say, an evolving morality, and how Lewis also predicted that in some of his books and the dangers of that for our kids when they have that sort of mindset. And so I think for people who are interested in how this is impacting us now, that's a good standard. I think also, the story about how Lewis went from believing that what he called the argument from undesign, that there's so much pain and suffering in the world, and that made atheism credible, to understanding that that was not sufficient and actually seeing that the evidence for design in the world and the universe was so even more powerful that forced him to confront his atheism and the sort of unreasonable basis of it. I think that story is a really interesting story that most people don't know about.
He did live through an incredible era, especially with that front seat there, right, in England, and his own experience in war. He watched what happens when ideologies, the isms, are allowed to rule in certain areas. It can be extraordinarily dangerous.
It can. And the other thing I appreciate about Lewis is in that time period, he was one of the few people who saw the dangers of totalitarianism on both the right and the left. At that time, there were many people who saw, Hitler was bad, but they loved Stalin, or they thought Stalin was bad, but they thought, oh, Hitler was this great strong man, in the early years. Lewis, from early on, in the 1920s and the early 30s, really was perceptive in seeing this abuse of totalitarianism on both the right and the left and calling it out. And that was really quite admirable. And then I'd say near the end of his life and ending decades, saw that the abuses of science had some of that same mindset, the people who were abusing it.
What would he say today, essentially, would be those isms that we may not even be aware are really beginning to blossom in our own society?
Well, I think one of the ones that that you actually alluded to earlier, of evolutionism, of using Darwin's theory of evolution to explain away religion, to provide evolutionary accounts of morality, to explain away human uniqueness, is still with us. And in fact, if anything, has gotten much more prominent. I mean, this is sort of, Lewis wrote about how Darwin's theory sort of almost was, the religion, times of dogmatic, and, that has become even more so. And so I think that's one of them. But I think also just in general, this reductionist approach, which says that human beings are just blind matter in motion. I mean, you can't go on the internet or just read anything today without confronting all sorts of people diminishing try and devalue our reason, devalue morality as just nothing but this product of this, you know, some blind other process. That, and I think that Lewis, that reductionism, Lewis was a very staunch critic of. And again, you see it today. Then actually one other thing, and people might not connect this, but, you know, when you believe in this sort of bleak scientific materialism, that science shows we're just nothing but blind matter in motion, for some people that can lead to a rejection of science, which is very sad, into completely non-rational, sort of, this might be the postmodern impulse of, you know, the people who claim that we can create our own reality. You know, some of that's coming from because people think that science leads to a really bleak view of the world, which is a tragedy because it doesn't. Science, properly understood, doesn't. It actually came out of a Judeo-Christian worldview and leads to a sense of wonder. But if you really believe what the materialists are saying, that science and rationality lead to this bleak view of the world, well, why not try to, you know, create your own reality? And Lewis actually prefigures some of that. You know, he read Nietzsche and others and prefigured some of that, what today we would call the postmodern impulse. Mm-hmm. And so he also was insightful in that area.
He is considered a great articulator of the Christian religion. It really was because he did use his reason so clearly and was able to, faith and reason, combining both of those. So for anyone to say that anyone who would question certain tenets of science isn't, it's not irrational by any sense.
No, and that is, Lewis is a great example. You know, people can, you know, obviously do attack him just like attack anyone, but here is this great Oxford and then Cambridge scholar who very much was very insightful use of reason. And I think, you know, to claim, it's hard to claim that here's just a stupid ignoramus who didn't know what he was talking about and was just a knee-jerk, you know, reaction to everything. No, he's a very thoughtful guy. And in his own intellectual journey from atheism to Christianity shows that and continues to show that, you know, throughout his life. And that's what makes him such a winsome figure, what makes, you know, the figures aren't absolute, but something like 200 million copies of his works have been sold. You know, people, even today, really are attracted by that winsomeness, just as they are to G.K. Chesterton and many others. You know, these are classic writers that speak to the ages.
That adherence to that scientism can be a squasher to human freedom, because to say that their answers, which they have come to understand today, which may not be the same answers they have tomorrow, which weren't the same answers they had yesterday, complete adherence to that can be crushing.
Yes, Lewis wrote a little essay that I urge everyone to read in the last full decade of his life in the 1950s called Willing Slaves of the Welfare State, where he actually addresses square on what you're talking about, which is the dangers to freedom of this mindset that, well, scientific knowledge alone, or at least people claiming to have scientific knowledge alone, is enough to decide what the government should do, what we should be allowed to do or not do, and that, you know, let's just cede over the reins of government and power to the experts. Sometimes they might call it the tyranny of the experts, and Lewis very much warned about that. Again, he wasn't against expert knowledge, neither am I. Obviously, if I ever have to have brain surgery, I don't want it done by someone with a mail order degree from someplace. And so, but the claim that the expertise alone allowed to dictate what freedoms we infringe on and other things, that is what Lewis pushed out against. He said everyone has the right to be part of that conversation.
It's a question of balance, isn't it? I mean,
yes, it is. And that is that sort of tunnel vision you get from the narrow expert that sees they may actually be good experts in their area of expertise, but they have blinders on. They don't see the full picture. That's why other people need to be involved in the conversation.
John, help us to understand why, because I think you probably experience more than most, the lack of virtue that is brought into these discussions. I mean, it becomes, what I'm trying to say is that in trying to have intelligent discussions with others about this, it descends on many occasions into name-calling and a host of other areas that, as I just said, is a lack of virtue.
I think it is, you know, when you're raising some of the deepest questions that implicate people of where are we from, where are we going, what is the purpose of life, what's the purpose of the universe, this can be a raw area for many people. And it and so I think it's defensiveness. Often from people who, although they may pontificate that, oh, the science shows everything else is, you know, atheism is the way to go and Christianity is idiocy, really, those are defense mechanisms, I think. They are speaking out of their own insecurity that they actually know in their heart of hearts that there's something there, and they don't want to confront it. And so it can be very hard. And Lewis actually was insightful in this and other areas in writing about people's psychology, of all the pretexts that, and excuses we make to not face the truth. And he actually talked about that in his own life, you know, that we put up, all the obstacles we put up. And it's not, as he pointed out, it's not that faith is contrary to reason. It's not. But we make all sorts of excuses so that we don't actually use our reason in it. And so I think that a lot of the people who cry the loudest and the most vitriolic are deeply hurting and insecure people, and it's actually very, very sad because they're not really wanting to deal with or confront the truth.
Well, and there's a potentiality, isn't there, of the division of thought, where there is, here is science on this side, here's your religious beliefs or your understanding of it may be an encounter of God. And keeping those separate, though, are important. Because how can you rationally think things through when religion is a matter of, they would say, maybe emotion?
Well, and, you know, the sad thing is there are a lot of Christians who buy into that. And they're doing it in order to, they think, to protect their faith. Well, our faith doesn't need to be patronized. And, I mean, God, if God is really the God of the universe, all truth is God's truth, and you don't need to be afraid of the teachings of reason. And God gave us our reason. And so those Christians who also want to say that, you know, faith and reason are just completely separate, I think, are really, that's unfortunate, because that's not true, and it's actually the Christian tradition has never really taught that, but I think in our modern or postmodern age, even a lot of Christians find refuge in that. Well, my faith, believing in spite of all what my evidence or reason says. Well, yes, there is a role for that sort of faith, but overall, really, our reason and nature really points towards the same God that I'd say the scriptures and the tradition point to.
That type of mindset, it permeates, again, all areas of society in a way, because even the pressure that's put on the modern media on how they express this, I mean, there's that stigma from Mencken's Inherit the Wind,
yeah,
that somehow, even that film and from that the work that he wrote, that somehow if you elevate or try to argue against it, you will come off as a buffoon. So best you just keep your mouth shut.
Yeah, and I think that Lewis is very helpful in that, because it's very hard to portray Lewis as a buffoon. And,
mm-hmm.
and Lewis understood some of those types of arguments, those rhetorical arguments. And, for example, in his own era, Middle Ages, think of, Galileo, Flat Earth, I mean, you name it, all the images that come to mind that are actually phony images.
Mm-hmm.
And Lewis, as a medieval and Renaissance scholar, was one of the early people to point out things like the idea that the people in the Middle Ages believed in the Flat Earth. No, sorry, they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
They believed the Earth was round. And the idea that Christendom were anti-science in the Middle Ages, no, sorry, not true. In fact, he, in his last book, it was as a scholar, called The Discarded Image, which was an exploration of the medieval worldview, one of the big themes is how the Middle Ages provided the basis for modern science in some of their ways of logically thinking, and how the scientific method grew out of that. And so Lewis was, now there have been many scholars since then who have pointed this out, but Lewis was one of the early scholars to actually point out that the Middle Ages was far from anti-science.
It's going to be a tremendous undertaking by anybody who tries to offer the alternative view at best. I was watching just recently a program on one of the cable historical channels that was supposed to be mankind's history within 10 minutes or something like that. And they so characterized that even during the Middle Ages, it was the Moors coming up into Spain, and they're the ones that kept science going, total negating the contribution of the Benedictines and the rise of the university system. I mean, that was just totally put aside, and that's what popular culture is being fed.
Yeah, and this does show, Lewis, and we have a section on this in the book, but Lewis pointed out that education is so important, and so that means also miseducation is important. And parents, you can't just cede to the state the responsibility of educating your kids. Whether or not they attend public schools or parochial schools or you homeschool, you need to be involved in the education of your kids, and that means undoing and providing them with the evidence of these other things, like the Christian contributions to the sciences, like a more true history of the history of thought and the history of faith and the history of science. And there are lots of great resources out there to do that, but you've got to take it on yourself to educate your kids. Don't cede it to the culture, because if you do, one day you'll wake up and you won't recognize your kids.
Fascinating. John, I wish we could talk to you more about this. We had more time. Any final thoughts?
People like sometimes think, this is ivory tower stuff. It doesn't affect me. It does affect you. And because a lot of things that you may see in the culture, whether it be the anti-life or other things, are being sold in the name of science. And so people of faith and people of non-faith need to get a handle on this abuse of science in order to be able to challenge not science, but this scientism, so that we might have a more wholesome, more whole culture.
And just quickly, to let folks know about the video that's also available to be able to kind of augment this work found in The Magician's Twin.
Oh, yeah. We were able to do a half-hour documentary inspired by the book, which many of the contributors were also in the video. And people can see it on YouTube. If they go to cslewisweb.com, they can not only download a chapter of the book, they can get the link to see The Magician's Twin video and sort of preview that for free.
Fascinating. John West, thank you so much.
Chris, thanks for having me. It's been enjoyable.
With John West, we've gone inside the pages of The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to cslewisweb.com, the website for the book and the video. To hear this discussion along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.